This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell.
Walking each other home is an exploration of the many ways we cultivate wisdom, compassion, and love in our lives. Mirabai Bush talks with some of her many diverse friends about what they're learning now from their spiritual paths and practices. If you would like to support this podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Mirabai.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Walking Each Other Home. I'm Mirabai, and today I have a great guest, Angel Acosta. He'll walk us home together. Angel's interest and work is about the coming together, the intersection of education, healing, community development, leadership, social justice. And he's done an amazing work. He got his PhD at Columbia Teachers College, and where he focused on healing education, or education in healing. He's also a member of the 400 Years of Inequality Project, for which he developed a program practice that is amazing, takes people through those 400 years and uses contemplative practice to help people process and be with what they've discovered by looking at it and reading it. It's I had a really extraordinary experience with it, and I just have great admiration for you for doing that. He's also currently the director of Garrison Institute's fellowship program, with a great group of fellows, and he serves as creative director of the New York City Healing Collective, a community initiative curating work and insights at the intersection of healing, wellness, and societal transformation. And I asked Angel today because this is just such a hard time. We're so in need of so many kinds of healing, which is his passion. There's, you know, we all know we're all still suffering through COVID, through sickness and loss and death and unemployment for some, and financial struggles for many of us, and the Black Lives Matter movement. And I just heard that Elijah McClain, who is this really beautiful 23-year-old who was a healer himself, a massage therapist, who was killed by police and paramedics. They just brought a grand jury just brought indictments against all five police, and they're replaying now that video, which is so heartbreaking. And then we have to look at the, you know, environmental crisis. And I mean, just this week, New Orleans, with the entire city with no power.
Yeah.
And dismantling structures that we're all part of racism and homophobia. And then this crazy polarization we're in and the challenges it makes to democracy. It's really serious. So we are all under stress, if not trauma. And we need to look at ourselves and our work for communities in a different way. So thank you, Angel, for coming. And I was going to start by asking you a beginning question. How did you first discover contemplative practices? And were, do you think, looking back now over your life after all these years, do you think, can you recognize seeds in your childhood that led to how you see things now?
Want to acknowledge you, Mirabai, and how much I care for you, and how much I appreciate this opportunity to be in dialogue with you. Beyond the other opportunities we get to talk, I'm excited for this conversation in particular, because we'll be able to always go deep, but go a little deeper into our shared interest in terms of healing-centered education and my work. I do want to say that it was an EDD program at Teachers College, Columbia University. And I tend to look at it as healing-centered work. And this is a good way to, this is a good way to talk and to even open up the conversation. You know, healing is one dimension of this process of approaching education. Not healing in and of itself. And later we'll talk a little bit about wounding and what is the role of wounding in the process. So the centered is really important to add for me next to healing. And we'll talk a little bit about that. So in this healing centered work, contemplative practices are a dimension. And you could, I mean, you could say that healing centered education is an extension of contemplative practice. You could also say that healing-centered education is an offshoot of contemplative practice as well, because they both mutually influence each other. They're part of ancient practices that we've had for a long time, you know, as a human community. And you as a practitioner and teacher know so much about that. And you've also been part of my own contemplative journey in some major ways, in some major levels. So I'm excited to tap into some of that as I think through that question. I mean, I think for me, contemplative practices, some of the first ones that I had were in college when I was just exploring. I studied anthropology in college. So I ended up in classes and in experiences that exposed me to a variety of cultural traditions and practices. Many of them spiritual in nature, others just communal. So I remember learning a little bit about yoga, learning a little bit about like randomly capoeira as a martial art practice in the Brazilian context. And there was something about embodied practice, but also kind of contemplative practice that made me curious about just the things that human communities deploy to be grounded. So I think some of my first contemplative practices were me just trying to do a little yoga, and then kind of not doing it for a while because I just didn't feel flexible enough. And then also doing a capoeira and trying a couple classes there. But initially, the initial contemplative practices were embodied in nature. And then I tried to learn how to meditate. I mean, I remember I couldn't do it for more than like 30 seconds. You know, I was like about 20 in college and learning the buzzword of meditation. And I finally kind of tried it and it was so frustrating. What is this? And then I made a connection between, because I was at this time studying anthro, but also investing in understanding issues of, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion in college, my graduate program. And I kind of saw a connection there between mindfulness, contemplative practice, and justice work. And then I decided to develop, to actually commit to a practice and learning more about the variety of practices that are out there, from mindfulness to breath work and all the other different kind of aspects of the healing arts. So that's how I would respond to that question. I'm sure there's more if I dug deep into my memory. But those are some of the initial exposures to contemplative practice. And then your other question about my childhood. Yeah, you know, I think I come from a really big family. You know, with Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico. And just in my father's side, you know, the ways that they tended to land, a lot of them were tobacco farmers and sharecroppers in Dominican Republic. The relationship to land was a practice. And you could tell by how grounded they were in the present moment. And it's also, you know, deeply influenced by like the Catholic tradition and prayer. I remember every 6 o'clock in Dominican Republic in the summers, my grandfather and my aunts would be in the living room for an hour reciting a particular chant for an hour. And I was 12, sometimes younger, just like, what is this? So on some levels, some of the ways that my culture and my family has just been in relationship to land and spirit, maybe have influenced how I'm able to just gravitate toward some of these practices and some of this research, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never really thought about that question before, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. That was great. So before we plunge into different aspects of healing, how do you understand healing? Or I was going to say define, but I don't want to sound too academic here, but it is the central question. What is healing? You know, so any way you want to talk about that.
Arabi.
Sorry. This is like, I remember being at my PhD orals. Oh, it was terrible. Questions would come out of nowhere. You know?
I'm here like, should I run a dissertation?
No, whatever.
Chapter one, page
Well, two. I'll say this. Many people talk about healing as wholeness, you know.
Well, I appreciate the question. I think it's an incredible question. And even there, that contribution, wholeness, you know. And I'll just say this before I respond to that question, that's such a profound question, that because of the rigorous nature of my graduate program at Georgia College as a social scientist, that I'm skeptical of even how I would define healing in any moment because of how relative it is. I'll tell you this though, that definitely wholeness is part of it. Let me ask us to consider like, why would we gravitate towards healing in this current moment, but also myself and my work? Primarily because of so much individual, collective, and interpersonal and structural trauma that exists in our society, period. Right? So, period, there's structural harm, there's interpersonal harm, there's personal, there's individual harm, there's, and the temper of the times are creating, obviously, because of just a reality that all you just mentioned in your opening, you know, the pandemic, unemployment, global tensions. At the same time, in not to sound too academic, but in the field and in various fields, like in the trauma studies field, in the mindfulness field, and in contemplative, in the contemplative space, and they're all adjacent spaces. There's just obviously they're responding to what's happening, and so that question that you just asked, what a lot of us are trying to answer, and I haven't found a profound enough definition that can really capture its essence. But I tell you one thing, that the process of trying to define it is healing in and of itself, or at least supportive of trying to define it in the first place. That's why I enjoy being skeptical of trying to define it in the first place, because I enjoy just wrestling with trying to define it. Last thing I'll say is that my colleague, Sister Kia Darling Hammond, she did a little bit of research on understanding what are the conditions that just help people thrive. Like what needs to be put in place for Mirabai to flourish? And she studied, in particular, she studied Black queer youth. And she spent even long study thinking about thriving in the community of youth that she was in. And she found that just asking youth that question around, what do you need to thrive? Like just asking and engaging in that inquiry was profound, was so helpful. So helpful. So I think it's, it may be the same for healing. I would say a form of, as a kind of restoration, as a kind of groundedness, wholeness, but an arrival at an awareness of presence, just like what I've been so busy looking at. That's why I'm struggling to even define it, because I've been so focused on different dimensions of healing, but even the healing itself, I struggle to nail it. But I can tell you that I definitely feel comfortable creating conditions where people feel like they belong, and people feel like they are seen and are part of a community and are part of a larger community that is making sense of the present moment, whether it be issues of or topics of justice or just in the classroom. Explore any subject matter, all that stuff is restorative and holistic. And I would dare to say that in some cases, healing. So it's just such a rich, rich question,
Wow. Thank you so much. One thing I found when I was thinking about healing, that the word whole is from the root, that the word heal is from the original root that meant whole. And what else comes from that is holy.
Yay.
I never even thought of those two things as connected. I mean, I know they're connected, but I thought that was really great.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm going to ask you... let's talk a little about the 400 years practice. I just want to say that I know that part of the work of moving into an area that has not really been well explored yet, in terms of contemplative practices, is that traditional practices just as they exist and have been handed down to us, often need to be adapted so that they're relevant and rich in the current context. And we saw that at Contemplative Mind a lot. But so I think that what you did, having the intention to help people heal from all that every single person has suffered around what happened in those 400 years, is brilliant. And maybe you could describe it and talk about some of your what the experience of some of the participants has been.
Such a good question. You know, the 400 Years of Inequality project originated at the New School under the leadership of Dr. Mindy Thompson Fully Love and so many other colleagues, Robert Fully Love, and so many others that I can name. And it was in direct response to the coming 400 year anniversary in 2019 of the arrival of enslaved Africans to Jamestown in 1619. And it was Mindy in particular, as and in 2016, was in an interview with a reporter, and a reporter asked her about if the African-American community felt a particular way in response to the Flint water crisis. Were they surprised? Were they disappointed? That was the question. And Mindy, I remember she telling me the story. Mindy was like, well, you know, structural issues like that in the context of the Black community have been happening since 1619. She just kind of said it in passing.
Oh, wow.
And in that moment, she was like, whoa. In the moment, she was like, wait, 1619, 2016, 2019. But, you know, and she's a social psychiatrist. So she, and an urban planner and so much more. And she knows the power of anniversaries. And the power of commemoration. But she decided to bring people together to this thing called the 400 Years of Inequality project. I'll just say that as she's having that realization, others are having the same realization, right? Mm-hmm. So you had Hannah Nicole Jones, sister from Nicole Jones from the New York Times 1619 Project, and that being. So many different groups throughout the U.S. and the U.S. in particular started to think about what would it mean to engage in like the intentional curation of material, experiences, communication campaigns to enable the country to reckon with this 400 year period, this legacy of four centuries. And I was in the doctoral program at the time and joined the committee. I was invited by Robert Fuller to join, and I'm in the meetings looking at the plans, and I spent about a year just with them, and they produced this timeline. You know, they produced this incredible 4x20 foot timeline with dates and images and text that it was a concentrated exploration through particular events in U.S. history that reinforced inequality, reinforced just oppression, but also displayed resilience in communities, right? And 1619 being one date, one significant date in that time. So you get a chance to see, the genesis of chattel slavery, the pillaging of indigenous land, the silencing of women's voices, the marginalizing of white poor laborers, and then you get into the 200 years, you get world wars and all kinds of things unfolding, GI Bill, you just see it all in different ways. You just see kind of this peppered these events peppered on this document, And I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. And at the time, you know, you and I were in a lot of dialogue because I was, I think I'm part of the board of C-Mind, and which I just deeply appreciated that experience. And I was really thinking about, okay, the power of contemplative practice. And I said, this is a lot. It's a lot to take this thing in. It's powerful, but it's a lot. And I remember saying, you know, we should probably develop a contemplative practice to support with the exploration of the actual timeline. I remember Mindy saying, why don't you do it then? And I was like, okay. And I decided to just develop a simple practice that would slow folks down before entering into a silent, you know, you would say, walking meditation through the timeline. And we started doing it in small groups. It resonated with people to just slow down before, right? Like slowing down before taking such information in. Mm-hmm. And then those initial practices in small groups just showed us that people were craving a deeper relationship with that history. And people were experiencing their own relationship to that history and how it brought up stuff in their own biography, their own stuff.
Absolutely.
Some of it that wasn't even related to what was on the map.
Mm-hmm.
So we coupled the practice, a simple grounding meditation practice in the beginning, with some journaling, and then with some kind of peer-to-peer communication opportunities. And then it just became like a restorative circle. Like it became a little bit more of a cohesive experience that was grounded by a practice, included communal and collective holding of what was coming up for everybody, but also people individually. And then we did it for like 2 years. I mean, I've probably walked maybe in the thousands, you know, like over 5,000 people through the timeline. Wow. A third of those are in person, and the rest probably in virtually. And that was just me. And the committee itself hosted these place-based observances nationally. And created like media kits and toolkits for communities to be able to do an observance of the timeline.
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't like, you know, a meditation is mandated, but in the toolkit, there was some prompting around like, you know, these are some options for how to engage in an observance of this timeline. And so the committee itself did stuff with 20 plus 30, 50,000. I mean, I forgot the numbers, but so it became a thing, you know, and a powerful force for deep conversations around that legacy. And I'm so proud of the work that the committee did. It transformed how I engage in teaching, period, because I learned so much would come up for people, and learning how to hold all of it and stumbling at times while holding it. So yeah, was some of the most profound educational experiences that I've witnessed and I've been able to be part of.
It's amazing. I am so happy to hear that many people went through it. Everyone should, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone should. I just, when we did it together, was at Omega.
Yeah.
And I remember that I walked through it, and I mean, I was really curious to see it all, but I thought kind of, well, I'm not going to have any like big awakenings. I've been studying this. I know about it, right? And I got stuck really early on. I couldn't leave this one place because what it showed was the, I had always thought of the oppression and genocide of Native American people as separate from enslavement, not from enslavement, but from black slavery.
Yeah.
And early on, I came upon something that showed me that it was the same time exactly, and mm-hmm. the same people were mm-hmm. doing it, and the same laws were supporting it, and it was all happening at once. And it was kind of like, of course, in a mm-hmm. way, and another way, it was like, oh my God, who were these people, you know, yeah. that could do that? I remembered that Daniel Boone, who was a, you know, he's like an American hero, right? It turns out he's an Indian hunter mm. and killer. Mm. And he lived with my great grandfather for a while in the mm. Carolinas. And I had known that. And then I looked at this thing and it was like, he was a major player, you know. It stunned me. And then we kept walking, and then there were so many other things. And when I went back and sat down, and you had had us all sit in silence at the beginning and then at the end for, I remember it as like 20 minutes, maybe it wasn't, yeah. but it seemed yeah. long and deep. I mean, long for that kind of thing. And then there were people in the room. There were about 30 people, maybe. Huh? And there were people in the room who had been a kind of, I don't know, there wasn't like a big breakdown during the weekend workshop, but you could tell there were people who were angry and defended about certain aspects around racism that would come up during the time. And there's one woman who, she spoke really softly, and there was an openness in the way she talked mm. about it when she, you know, talked after the whole thing. And I realized kind of just from that little example, and that the rest of the room, you could feel it also, but such hard things to talk about. Mm. People were really, you know, mm-hmm. felt like they're really able to take it in and then to speak quite personally about mm. it. It's a powerful practice.
Yeah, that practice taught me a lot. And it just pointed to just the power of practice, period. Like just one little simple thing could have a very deep shift-inducing effect on a learning process. And as you know from, you know, C-Mind and many other organizations you've been part of and have supported, you know, many of them that are connected to assessing and evaluating and researching this stuff, that's just something that we now can integrate in our, that's why I think partly mindfulness has been so popular and so has penetrated so many different industries, from business to education, the medical field, you know. There is something about slowing down and taking one's time and connecting to breath, connecting to space. That's just some aspects of practice. Different awareness-based practices. And back to the initial question that started this conversation around healing, you know, is that there's something about contemplative practice, mindfulness practice, awareness-based practice that enables us to obviously become more present in the moment and, you know, experience stress reduction in the moment and a sense of calm. But I think it also, you and I were discussing this at a different point, it enables us to feel our own sense of wholeness, you know, in the moment. And that's pretty significant, I think.
Absolutely. It is the whole thing. Yeah. Presence. I think, I heard you talking about presence in one talk you gave. And it's so core to education. that, you know, when people are mm-hmm. fully present in the moment, we can hear each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, you know, and you said so much in the beginning. One of the things you said was just how polarizing this moment can be. And I, you know, we're experiencing it in a very particular type of way in the U.S. And, you know, there are different regions that are experiencing similar types of kind of fragmentation and polarization. And it sometimes, depending on the issue you're exploring or the current event that is unfolding, it almost feels like we can't even hear each other. You know, there's so much, you know, and so there's so much there around thinking about presence, what's required, what, how can we enable it, you know. And then also, you know, there's a lot of powerful integration happening in different communities. Like, I think as we hold, you know, all the challenges that are unfolding before us, I've also noticed that people are responding and communities are engaged. And, you know, I've seen beautiful work, beautiful art, beautiful music unfold in this moment. You know, so it's holding that paradox. I think practice facilitates that as also. It's giving sure. us the ability to just become aware of all, at least not all of it, because that's hard, right? All of it, but to enough of it where you could have some perspective beyond whatever aspect of it may be inducing or creating a lot of suffering.
Yeah. And so when you take these insights and try to build what you call healing-centered education, did I get it right?
Yeah.
What is that? What has that looked like? Or what are you looking toward?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I get excited about that question because, so healing-centered education is not, it's not new, you know, it's more a framing of what already exists in a slightly, in a different way. So for example, mindfulness, restorative justice, social emotional learning, yoga, the healing arts, they all, in this present moment, if you look closely at how communities are using them in education and also beyond, there's just a zeitgeist in the ether that these modalities, these pedagogies, are now being used more in more fields, right? So education and business and the medical field. So healing-centered education is kind of almost like a meta theory, a meta way to kind of just see how all this stuff is coming together. And can be used to create experiences that either in the classroom or if you're a consultant in institutions that could support communities with deeper learning, stronger communal ties, self-inquiry, you know. So for example, there's just, like yesterday I was teaching a healing-centered practicum course. And I just invited a poet to come and share her poetry and maybe do a couple writing prompts and exercises with the community. And, whoa, I mean, she recited like four or five poems around her her origin story and her relationship to men and to community members that were difficult, and her how she transcended them. And then she invited people through particular writing prompts to write their own poems. And then she invited people a couple people to share them. And then she had folks just be in small groups and share what they had written. And then we held space for all of it after, for all of what that experience did for them. And, oh, it was heart-opening. You know, people shared so much about their own biographical experiences, but also how they're responding to the current moment with grief and anxiety and concern. Many teachers who are now going to teach in the fall and have to think about, you know, Delta and you know, all kinds of challenges. So in that moment, in that case, a healing-centered practice could be a writing practice that brings you back to you, that brings you back to a sense of connection to just your past. That's just kind of an example that's most immediate for me. But again, like I said before, these are practices that have already existed. You know, so it's just now being intentional about creating a restorative experience and process for the individual, for the community, or for those folks like Thomas Hubel and others who are thinking about collective healing. Like, what does it mean to be? That's a big, you know, big question. What is collective healing? In fact, there's a summit coming up, I think, and the theme is, what is collective healing in action? You know, so very big, bold questions that are important.
Yeah. Would you, let's see, tell us a little about how you create a safe, opening, welcoming space for people to, I mean, as you said, many of those practices, like writing practices, have existed for a long time. But a lot has to do with the invitation into addressing it in deeper ways, more open ways, ways that can heal. How do you create kind of space that that welcomes that?
Yeah. It reminds me of one of the voices in this movement and in this kind of approach. I mentioned her work earlier, Dr. Kia Darling Hammond, and you know, she thinking about to create a space like that is to be intentional about not only creating a space that is safe, but a space where people can feel a sense of belonging, a sense of thriving. And she in particular talks about five dimensions of thriving. One of them is that there has to be a sense of community. Like there has to be some kind of shared sense of identity. At least, and at the very least, that there's a common purpose that is shared, and that you feel a sense like you're respected there, and it can be there, whether it's a learning community or a family or a you know, community in a particular neighborhood. But so there's a sense of community that has to be built, and you know, so it's a series of moves that you can make as a teacher and as a facilitator or as a guide. One, what kind of practices and rituals or experiences are you facilitating? So that people can get to know each other on the one hand, but also get a sense for developing, co-creating a shared sense of community culture. Then there's, you know, feeling a sense of abundance, like not financial though, but rather like you feel like you yourself feel like you're enough and that you have enough in that space.
Yeah.
So it's slightly different side kind of abundance. Pleasure, you know, that the that it's joyful, you know, that you can enjoy, you know, this, the whatever process you're facilitating, especially. And I think that connecting it to the 400 years of inequality, the contemplative practice we designed, was that even after facilitating that very difficult journey hundreds of times, there was always at the end a deep sense of appreciation and almost pleasure that was experienced with having had the opportunity to not just experience the timeline, but be in community together. So, you know, creating a healing space, you know, there's no exact formula, but I think we're at the moment now where there is enough in the field, you know, from all the diversity, equity, and inclusion of a phenomenon and practice that are coming out of just the workforce and in different industries. And again, the mindfulness field and restorative justice. It's just a great time to, for that question to become alive for all of us. You know, all of us at the family level, at the level of work, the level of society. So yeah, just some quick responses there, but you know, we can talk for hours about that one.
We could. I wish we could. Yeah, because it's, so we don't really have time to talk about.
Well, since people are going to edit this, let's keep talking until we feel like we're complete.
Oh, okay. If you have time, good.
Yeah. I'll just push what I got to do next. I think we can do 15, 20 more minutes. I mean, let's see where we get with the next questions, but we can just land and close organically.
And we do want to remember that you were going to lead a practice.
Yeah. I invite you to kind of whatever's still kind of percolating for you. You know, I really want us to close out and ground the discussion in an organic way. You know, I think we've gone deep, and it just shows how much deeper you can go. There's so much that, you know, that's why I appreciate this work so much.
I think you made it indirectly, but powerfully, the connection, which is often hard for people to understand, the connection between our individual work of healing and deepening and waking up to the work with community or the connections with community. As you know, people have often thought that, you know, doing this work, whether it's, you know, everything from deep meditation to psychotherapy or whatever, they tend to think, and it's also American influence, that it's just about me. And that I think in everything you said, you were really clear that it's that the connection between the individual and the community is that we need each other. That's why I call this podcast Walking Each Other Home. We need each other to wake up, and the community is made up of lots of individuals who are more than individual. Anyhow, it's a little stumbling, but it's so important, and it's often not honored and talked about, really.
The as we think about collective healing, we have to think about individual healing as well, and that we can all do a little work. We can all do a little work.
Yes, we could. Related to that, we talked before a little about intergenerational trauma and healing.
Yeah.
Do you have something you'd like to say about that?
Yeah. You know,
people are just really becoming aware of it.
Yeah. You know, formally the field of, what do you call it, trauma studies, or just you know, the field of psychology in terms of understanding the impact of trauma, you know, from understanding PTSD and, you know, post-traumatic stress, and ACEs, adverse childhood experience. Like, we know a lot about trauma, and in that very same field, just in the biological part or focus, epigenetic trauma, how, you know, communities can, or people can carry trauma that is transferred through, it's intergenerational. And based on some of that work, we know that it can literally transfer between 4 to 7 generations down a particular, you know, community or individual. And at the same time, there's the resilience. There's intergenerational resilience that can be transmitted and transmuted and channeled. And you see it. You see it in so many different communities, like even in the Native American community in the United States. You know, it takes an incredible level of resilience to survive. You know, your land being stolen, being pushed on to reservations, and you know, sent to boarding schools. You know, just take a moment there to just acknowledge all the bodies of the children that are re-emerging in Canada in particular, but, you know, in the U.S. as well, there are those sites in that. If you want to acknowledge that, it takes a lot, you know. So that's why formally, right, if you think about healing, and the initial question that you asked around what is healing, when I spent time studying this stuff, I noticed that the initial response to colonization, imperial rule by indigenous people, especially in the Western Hemisphere, in Canada, the U.S., like the response to that, the practices for cultural and psychic preservation, there you see evidence of healing-centered pedagogies and practices. That was one of the most insightful findings. But even though there are these healing-centered practices, or these practices that are awareness-based, or however you want to call them, that are transmitted and handed down through ancient traditions, that in particular, culturally, that community's response to just the last 400 years of just social, legal, and political oppression creates some unique conditions. And in the Black community as well, and in other communities. But just fascinating to think about that response generated a level of resilience as well. And you see it, in the way people dance. You see it in the way people sing. You see it in the arts. You see it in just how people keep on keeping on. Regardless of present conditions.
So you have thought and know a lot about what we inherit and what we pass on. You've been thinking about that a lot. Now I'm going to ask you a very personal question. Has your thinking changed? How do you think about it now that you are a father of a very new baby? It must come up into your mind.
Yeah. You know, just shout outs to little Sydney Angel Acosta, my son, 9 weeks. He's definitely an old soul. And shout outs to my wife, Christina. I just think that becoming a father has been more tender and, and then open to being more and more vulnerable to just what it means to show up right now as a father, as a friend, as a person. And I think all that contributes to how you, one of the first words you use in response to what healing is wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
And part of wholeness being partly just acceptance and accepting. So that's what I would say right now.
Thank you. I hope it was okay I asked you that.
Yeah.
It was a great answer. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd love it if you'd lead a little practice for us.
I would love.
And, you know, this will be posted on the Be Here Now Network. There'll be a page for it. And on that page, we will list anything that people, some videos, some of your videos, and then also some things that people can connect with you on, you know, if you have things that are open, and any other information you want to put up there, you know. So we'll build that in time for people who are hearing it now. We'll be able to reach all of that because there's so much I know that you could have said and didn't, but there's more to come.
So I'd love to hold space for a practice. Would you like me to lean into that now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So just want to begin a practice, at least for myself on my end, giving gratitude for this conversation and being grateful for Sister Mirabai and beginning to just pay attention to my body and how it feels in this present moment. I want to invite everybody listening to just settle into your body in the most comfortable way possible for you in this present moment. It can be just sitting down. If you're seated, just comfortably. See if you can experience a sense of ease. Even if just in how your body just rests in this moment. Allowing yourself just to breathe in your own way, at your own pace. If it is supportive, I invite you to gently close your eyes. You can keep them open if you'd like. Just sensing into this moment. Presencing, becoming more and more aware of your breathing. See if you can sent into your next exhale. See if you can sent into and become aware of your next inhale. Any thoughts that are emerging or coming up, acknowledging them and just gently bringing your attention right back to your breath. Taking in a deep, gentle inhale. And a gentle exhale. Sensing and feeling into your belly, rising as you take that precious oxygen in. Feeling that belly just descend and deflate, and it helps just to empty your lungs. Just taking a few more deep breaths here at your own pace, at your own time. As we bring this practice to a close, see if you can think of someone, anyone, someone close, someone you might not know too well, and just extend the accumulated attention and intention that we generated from this practice. Just to extend that in the form of compassion to that person. And hold that for a moment. Taking in one more gentle, deep breath. And as you exhale, just slowly opening your eyes if you had them closed. Slowly becoming more aware of your surroundings, your chair, your seated, your room. Moving a little bit if you'd like, and just being grateful for this moment and this practice. I thank you for joining me in that.
Thank you, Angel. Thank you so much. It was really wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Maribel.
Take good care of yourself and your family, and may you all be happy and free. And safe.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.